Sundays with the Modern, in which we invite prominent art historians, artists, curators, gallerists to speak on selected works on view. The series continues weekly through the end of January, with the exception of the Christmas and New Year's holidays. And you can find a list of the speakers at themodern.org. Dr. Mark Thistlethwaite holds the Kay and Velma Kimball Chair of Art History at TCU, where he's won numerous teaching awards. Mark holds his doctorate from the University of Pennsylvania and specializes in the art of the United States, while also teaching courses in contemporary art, modern and postmodern architecture, and the history of graphic design. As a scholar, he has published books and articles on 19th century and contemporary art, particularly on the subject of history painting. He's a longtime friend of this museum and currently serves on the board. Please welcome Mark Thistlethwaite.
Thanks. I'm pleased to see you here today. We're going to walk in and camp in front of the Ben Shahn painting. This is an intimate group, so we can be intimate. Oh, here comes the fillers for it right now. Well, as I said, I'm glad to see you all here. I'm delighted to be here. And it's been a nice opportunity because when Terry asked me, I didn't realize the upper floor was going to be an installation, and so there was a limited number of works to talk about. Which I took as an opportunity, as we like to say at TCU, when the dean calls you and says, have I got an opportunity for you? There wasn't a whole lot to select from, but there's always lots to see and lots to talk about. And I am particularly delighted that this work is up and has been for a while. It's a work that has maybe seemed to you, as it sometimes does to me, a little odd to be in this gallery where you've got Rothko and you've got Reinhardt and you've got Pollock across the way and then the other abstract expressionists and even artists who aren't abstract expressionists but working in a still abstract fashion. And this seems in some ways a little bit old-fashioned perhaps and a bit at odds. It's by Ben Shahn and it's called Allegory and it's from 1948. Shahn was not part of the abstract expressionist group, but he was extraordinarily well regarded in the mid-20th century. In fact, the year that this is painted in, it's a tempera on panel. It's painted in 1948. That year, Look magazine, which was the competitor to Life magazine, had a poll that they generated, polling various artists, curators, critics, about who they thought were the 10 best painters working in the United States. Shahn was one of those. Anybody have an idea who was number one? Want to take a guess? No. I'm glad. Pollock. No, Pollock was not on the list, as far as I know. Actually, I haven't been able to find the list except for seven names, which is really weird. It's the one thing you can't find on the web for some reason. 48, though, coincidentally, Pollock sold a painting, number 15, for the highest price ever paid. It was sold to a private collector by an American artist. But the next year, in 1949, Pollock was written about in Life magazine under the heading, Is This America's Greatest Artist? So there was a sea change occurring. The number one artist was John Maron, an artist that, again, is sort of like Shahn, not that well remembered today, hugely popular and considered preeminent as an artist. I know second place went to an artist that many of you probably have not heard of, Yasuo Kuniyoshi, which the Carter had an exhibition a couple of years on Kuniyoshi's work that Jane Myers put together a couple of years ago. Actually, he was third. Max Weber another not household name was on the list. And then you had Edward Hopper and Stuart Davis. But Ben Shahn was on the list of the 10 preeminent painters considered by critics, museum people, and artists in 1948. And that was continued well into the 50s. In 1954, he, along with Willem de Kooning, who was very much part of the abstract expressionist movement, were the American representatives at the Venice Biennale that year. So again, he was highly regarded, not only as a painter, but as a printmaker, as a photographer, and also as an illustrator. And it's in that quality that also I was delighted this work was here. You remember the Andy Warhol show that was here a few months ago. Andy Warhol, when he was an illustrator, was very much influenced by Shahn's illustrations. Shahn did these funny little dotted drawings that Warhol picked up on and really made it his style. So his impact was quite great. On a personal level, I came across in my Shahn file, which was rather dusty, a paper I had written as an undergraduate. And it was on the Sacco and Vanzetti series that Shahn had created in 1931 and 32, which was a very controversial, still is a case that's argued about whether innocent men were put to death or not, and it keeps getting revised sort of every year. But I had written a senior paper on that, and I had been interested in Shahn for a long, long time. So again, it's nice to be able to talk about this work to some extent. Also, Shahn, in 1956 and 57, was named the Charles Eliot Norton Professor at Harvard. It's an honorific position in which you're required to give 4 or 5 lectures, but very prestigious. Those lectures are typically published a generation, more than a generation later. Frank Stella did a series that were published and very influential on artists. Shahn's essay or lectures were gathered in a book called The Shape of Content. This is my supplementary visual material that I'm bringing in. This is a well-worn copy, and actually it's a copy I've had since high school, I think. It's a book I highly recommend if you've never read it. It's kind of a classic in terms of an artist talking very articulately about his work. How he conceives it, what goes into it, the history of ideas. And he was a very intelligent guy. And so it's still a good read. I read it again, and I remembered being really excited when I read it. Kind of shake my head certain times when I read it now. But it's for, particularly I think for younger people, undergraduates, it's a great read. He has a chapter in here. It's the second chapter. Well, I love the first chapter. It's called Artists in Colleges. And he said one of the problems with artists in colleges, and I'm sort of sad but happy to know that nothing's changed since the mid-50s, is that colleges lack the imagination to deal with artists. And that colleges, by their nature, are all about categorizing and analyzing and, bean counting and so forth. The second chapter is called The Biography of a Painting, and it's all about this painting. And I highly recommend it to you. And he also, the publisher, included as the frontispiece a color illustration, a reproduction of this work. So this was an important work for Shahn. It was a very significant work for him, and in a way a kind of change in his style and not so much the subject matter, although to a degree that as well. Shahn had become well known in the 1920s and 30s, 40s as a social realist. And this was a movement that, as its title might indicate, they were artists who were realistically painting social issues, political concerns, but also what was going on in American society. It's very much related to the Depression years. And they were artists that usually had an agenda in their works. And he worked in that fashion, along with other artists you may know, like Philip Evergood and the Sawyer brothers, Raphael, Isaac, and Moses, were social realist artists. And about a dozen other artists were identified with that movement. It was very topical art. And it's work that you look at today, and unless you really know the story, you're kind of lost. And in painting this work, Sean was thinking more of blending topicality with a universality. And he thought of that as a real change for him. And it was a painting he thought a lot about. And in fact, it was he thought a lot about it after it was actually finished. Because in 1948, when it was shown at the annual exhibition of contemporary art that the Whitney held, it was written about in the New York Sun newspaper by Henry McBride, who was one of the leading art critics of the day and was a friend of Sean's. And he wrote pretty favorably about this work until he got to the end of his review. And he said that basically it was unfortunate that Ben Sean was presenting, and the phrase he used was a subtle tribute to our former friend and now contemporary enemy, the Soviet Union. And Sean read that, and he thought, I didn't intend that at all. But McBride was reading this idea of a red beast and associating it with communism. 1948, the Cold War is really starting at that moment. Sean was initially offended, and then he thought, well, let me think about this. You know, why would he say that, and yet it's not my intention at all? What does it really mean to me? And the essay, the biography of a painting, really deals with how he dealt with that that interest and his desire to sort of analyze it. Because he basically said, you know, the two schools of thought of art criticism is one is formalistic, and the other is more subjective of reading into it. And it got him thinking, to say the least, and being very, in his own way, trying to be rather analytical in articulating his ideas. The work comes out of an actual incident, and it does blend ultimately the topical with a kind of larger universality. And Sean emphasizes that in his writings about this work. He was commissioned by Harper's Magazine in 1948. So in 48, he did some drawings for an article in Harper's and produced this painting. It was shown, it was written about, and he was beginning to think of his responses to it. The Harper's, I brought in the copy of the article because it had illustrations by Sean, which these two in particular would show a tenement burning and also a group of figures you can see relate to, certainly the flames relate to the beast's flame-like fur at the top of it, and the four people that are lying here clearly relate to the people that are here. This was an article written by John Bartlow Martin, which it was called The Hickman Story, and it was about an African-American family in Chicago who in just the prior year, 1947, they had suffered a catastrophic loss. They lived in worst possible living circumstances in a tenement, in a really run-down building in Chicago. They lived in the attic. It's a very complex story, and it has to do with social injustice, racial injustice, safety rules being cast aside, and so forth. They had continually complained to the owner of the building. The Hickman family were African Americans. The owner of the building was African American as well. And that repairs needed to be made, that it was a fire hazard. The owner kept saying, well, I just want you to move because I want to subdivide this place into apartments, and you know, maybe the place will catch on fire and you'll have to leave. When John Hickman, the father, was at work, he worked a night shift in a steel mill. When he came home, he came upon the building having been burnt during the night. And four of his children died in the fire. Two of the children escaped along with the mother, three of the children with the mother, but four died. Hickman, as you imagine, was devastated. He fully blamed it on the owner of the building. And the next day, he went and shot to death the owner of the building. It went to trial. It was initially a hung jury, and then the judge ruled that he was guilty by reason, or by reason of insanity, lessened the charge to manslaughter and gave him 2 years probation, so he never went to jail. But it was one of these, you know, heart-wrenching stories that was all about loss and all about devastation and so forth. And in doing these drawings, and he did about a half dozen of them for the article, it really affected Sean, and he kept coming back to those drawings. And he began to think about the idea, the larger idea, basically, of evil and of death, violent death. And that began to lead to this. And he also said it really brought up memories of his childhood. He had grown up his first 8 years in what was called the Pale of the Settlement in basically Western Russia today, or even larger. It went from the Baltic to the Black Sea and include parts of Poland today and the Ukraine and Lithuania. And he had lived there 8 years, and while he was there, the village he lived in, his grandfather's house had caught on fire. And there was, you know, this huge fire. And in this work, if you look very closely, there are these trees over here that it's a very odd element. It's almost like it's kind of collaged into it. It's almost like another little vignette. And that may be a kind of reference to that village of fire. He also, when the family moved to Brooklyn, there had been a fire in their building, and his father had managed to get everyone out. So fire was something on his mind personally, and he was thinking about it in terms of the destructive quality of it and so forth, and particularly in the case of the Hickman case, how it had probably been an arsonist involved in it. So he began to work on this work, and he decided to give it more of a symbolic quality rather than the more specificity to the Hickman story that the illustrations had. And this was important for him because it was a change. He really hadn't been dealing with symbols. He thought they were rather old-fashioned, that they wouldn't necessarily work. But he felt this was had such a depth to it, because he kept coming back and using the phrase, this was about an inner disaster. And by that he meant a really deep, deep disaster that affected not only people, specific people, but everyone. There was a universality to this, and he wanted to convey that. So he created this beast-like form. It's basically coming out of the notion of the mythological Greek creature called the chimera, which had the body of a lioness, had a tail with a serpent's head on it, and then also, and you don't find that here, but had a goat's head coming out of the middle of its back. But he's sort of playing off of that idea of this beast that is ultimately overall in this particular case, and this, you know, wonderful kind of non-space. I mean, that's, again, the sort of floating forest over here. It's also, I think, intriguing in terms of 1948, because that is the time when abstract expressionism is becoming well-known. And abstract expressionism, particularly in the early 40s, was itself very much concerned not only with abstraction, but dealing with universal myths. And it was something that Rothko and Newman, Gottlieb in particular, all talked about and wrote about, that they were concerned with, as they said, the timeless and the tragic, which comes out of mythology. And Pollock did a number of paintings, She-Wolf, for example, and Pasiphae, which refers to the legend of the island of Crete and the labyrinth, that had specific titles. Antigone was the title of one of Rothko's early works. So they were interested in myth, too. So in a way, Sean is in step with that idea of blending the personal, abstract expressionism is nothing if not personal, with the more universal. And you find that in this work. But he does it in an allegory, and he gives it that title. An allegory is typically a figurative mode of representation that conveys meaning other than its what seems to be the literal meaning. And it's also usually allegory usually presents or offers a lesson in symbolic terms. So that's on his mind. He will, in fact, do three paintings titled Elegy. This is the first, one in 1953 and one in 1955. And they have been written about, the ones from the 50s, as sort of emblematic of the Cold War, in particular the threat of the atomic bomb. And Francis Pohl is an art historian who's written about it in those terms. This is a work that's sometimes related to the Holocaust. And it's sort of a natural connection I think you make, in part because of this grouping of figures that seems to resemble photographs we've seen of victims of the Holocaust. Sean was Jewish. A lot of his work dealt with Jewish subject matter. Sean also, during the Second World War, worked for the Office of War Information. And that office was among the first of any of the branches or various offices to receive photographs of the concentration camps. And so early on, Sean had seen this work. He always, though, indicated that it's not about the Holocaust, that that's part of what it may be about, but it's not specifically meant to be that. It is interesting, in this article that Martin writes on the Hickman story, he quotes a fire chief who's at the scene of the fire, and the fire chief's first words are, "It's a Holocaust." So that term, which refers to burning, is again multi-layered, I think, in how he means it. He is, I think, on some level referring to the Holocaust, but again, it's a larger image. And in some ways, it's very different stylistically, but it puts me in the mind of Anselm Kiefer's Quaternity in this collection, which is dealing with that issue of evil in the world. How can God and evil be in the world? And that has fire in it as well, that attic scene, which is also kind of interesting in terms of the attic being where the Hickman family lived, and you know, the sort of connections that one could maybe spin off from that. So Sean, and this is a very significant painting for him, for a very significant artist at this moment. He referred to it as an idea painting. So he really was thinking about it conceptually. He also, in sort of three wonderful sentences, I think he says it's an idea painting, it's a highly emotional painting, but it's also fundamentally a paint image. Like any artist, he's coming back to the fact that it's a work of art for him. It's a composition. It's a painting. And it has to work at that level also. So it's, again, I think it's a really intriguing composition, and a work that is sort of rich with meaning. I think it's a work that when people spend time looking at it, you begin to, you know, sort of unpack the meaning, at least in your own terms. How you relate to it. Anyone have any questions? And then I just thought of one other thing I want to say.
Initially, I wasn't sure if the figure was protecting or had killed those people. I mean, without the background, is there anything to help us with that interpretation?
No, I don't know if you could hear the question, but the creature sort of looks like it could be a protective creature as well as a fiery creature. And I think that's part of, again, that notion that Kiefer deals with, the good and evil, and that sort of two sides of things or two possibilities of seeing things. I think Sean saw it more as a negative form. And what I was going to say that I just remembered was that there's a kind of linkage, which also relates to your comment about protective, that ties it to the she-wolf, the traditional founder of Rome, who suckles Romulus and Remus, and you know they found Rome, I should say. And that idea of these figures underneath there is that sort of quality about it, but at the same time, it is this beast-like quality that I mean, you could even ask, certainly, are they sleeping or are they dead? I mean, again, he's trying to, like many, many artists, walk this line of being specific in this case and being more open, more universal. And again, that's new for him because he he was used to sort of hitting you over the head with his social realist paintings. And his, he did a lot of posters where, you know, you're really, you're not wondering what it means.